Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center video webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. Considering that it's August, we have a very large audience today. I know I've been saying this for weeks, but today's audience is totally amazing. So I am going to introduce the JPC and our work yet again. If you've heard it before, okay, hear it again. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by scholars, academics, and commentators. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, and most important these days, free speech and intellectual diversity. You can read our publications, Insight, In Context, Alliance Tracker, Frontline Defense, and InFocus Quarterly on the website at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. This is our last webinar until after Labor Day, but I would encourage you to go to the website and see what you might have missed. Claudia Rosette on Hong Kong. Hong Kong seems to have disappeared from the news. Please don't let it. Richard Goldberg on Iran sanctions, Dan Blumenthal on China, plus Arsen Ostrovsky, Jonathan Shanzer, Ilya Shapiro, and others. We thought we would cut for the summer with a truly fine guest, Michael Duran, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, who specializes in Middle East security issues. Mike served in the Bush White House as a senior director on the National Security Council, where he was responsible for helping to devise and coordinate U.S. strategy on a variety of Middle Eastern issues, including Arab-Israeli relations and efforts to contain Iran and Syria. He also served as senior advisor in the State Department and Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Pentagon. He received his BA from Stanford University and an MA and PhD from Princeton University. Before coming to Hudson, Mike is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He also has held teaching positions at NYU, Princeton, and the University of Central Florida. His book, Ike's Gamble, was reviewed in Focus Quarterly. I strongly recommend it. It's about this 1956 Sinai campaign and about a lot of misunderstandings the United States government had about the Middle East, the players, and the politics at the time. And 24 years later, you can draw your own conclusions. He appears regularly on television, and he has published in all the places you would expect him to publish, from the Wall Street Journal to Commentary to Mosaic. He wrote a terrific piece recently entitled China's Emerging Middle Eastern Kingdom for Tablet Magazine. And he's going to talk to us today about China's plans. Let me remind you, your microphones are muted, but if you have questions, please email them to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. And now, Michael, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Shoshana. And thanks to the JPC for hosting this and to all of you for tuning in. When we sat down to write this article, I co-wrote it with my colleague at Hudson, Peter Rao. We had a sense that that China was playing an increasing role in the Middle East. And we had a sense that its role was being somewhat underestimated. But I think even us, even the two of us were shocked. We were really surprised by what we found when we started just collecting the data and putting together the totality of what the Chinese were doing, and then trying to figure, to make sense of it in any kind of, as part of a coherent, as a coherent strategy. Before we did any research, I had the sense of, you know, China, I could feel China's influence. I think the way that astronomers understand the influence of black holes, you know, they see other actors, they see celestial bodies changing their orbit in ways that don't make sense. And the only way you can make sense of it is to say, oh, there must be a black hole over there that is making their orbit deviate. That's the kind of sense that I had about what was going on in the region. Then we collected the data and we found really surprising things. For example, there's one Arab country in which over the period 2010 to 2018, this is when you have the best data, China's bilateral trade and investment increased with that country by over 1,000%. I'll ask you. You guys can't. You can't answer here in this forum. But I'll ask you to guess. Is it Saudi Arabia? Is it Iran? Is it the UAE? No, it's Iraq. I did not know this. I consider myself to be an expert on the Middle East. I had no idea that the Chinese were so heavily invested in Iraq, and that clearly they had made a strategic decision to focus on Iraq. Another surprising thing that came to me was the connection between the genocidal policies of the Chinese against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang and their Middle East policy. There's a reason why the Chinese are doing what they're doing. China is not friendly to minorities. I would say, but it hasn't traditionally been hostile to them in the way that it's hostile to the Uyghurs. You can speak Mongol and still be left alone in China. There are lots of minorities in China. The Han Chinese population is just so large that they don't feel threatened by the minorities. And some of the minorities are very large by international standards. But the persistence of minorities in China shows you that genocide is not in the norm for in Chinese history. So why are they doing it to the Uyghurs? Well, the answer is the Uyghurs are in the path between China and the Middle East. The Middle East is the second most important region to China after the Western Pacific. And if you look at the Middle East from Beijing, there's an intimate connection between the balance of power, hard power balance in the Western Pacific and the Middle East, because China is very dependent on oil imports. It's overwhelmingly dependent on oil imports and very dependent on the Middle East. And even that oil that doesn't originate in the Middle East that goes to China goes through the Middle East to get to China. And right now it has to go through the Suez Canal or come from the Persian Gulf and then go through the Straits of Malacca up to the east coast of China. In time of war, if there was a war between Taiwan or Japan or the United States and China focused on the Western Pacific, then that sea lane would be completely closed to Chinese shipping. So China is strategically vulnerable because of its long energy supply lines. And what the Chinese are doing is they're trying to shorten and harden those supply lines by building a port in Pakistan, which is called Gwadar, and then they're building a land corridor from Gwadar up to Xinjiang, from which imports will then be distributed eastward in the rest of China. So if you look at the map and here's China, here's India, here's Pakistan. Pakistan is a corridor down to the Indian Ocean, and in fact they have a major project there called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is the jewel in the crown of the Belt and Road Initiative. It is the single most important component of the Belt and Road Initiative. And that is not just China's corridor to the Indian Ocean, it's China's corridor to the Middle East. In addition to shortening and hardening their own supply lines, what they are trying to do as well is to position themselves so that they threaten the supply lines of all of their East Asian rivals. That's Australia, not just East Asian, all of their Asian rivals. That's India, Australia, Taiwan, South Korea, all of whom are overwhelmingly dependent for oil from the Middle East, or again, from oil that comes through the Middle East. To give just one example, Japan has virtually no domestic supplies of oil and gas. Almost all of Japan's supplies, or at least over 80%, come from the Persian Gulf. Gwadar, this port that the Chinese are building there, right now they're telling us it's a commercial venture, but it's going to become a military base. If I were a betting man, I would bet my house that within the next 10 years or less, that is going to become a naval base. It's just too valuable to China for it not to be a naval base. And once it is a naval base, it is within easy striking distance of the Strait of Hormuz. Gwadar looks out onto the Gulf of Oman, and it will be the sister base of a base that the Chinese already have in Djibouti. This is the only overseas base that the Chinese, that the People's Republic of China has ever built. Technically, they had one in North Korea, which they closed in 1958. I don't know if North Korea counts as an overseas base, but if anybody out there is going to call me on that, basically the only base they've ever had, certainly the only one they've ever had outside of the Pacific. It's in Djibouti. Now, we've been telling ourselves for the longest time, oh, it's an African base. Well, Djibouti sits on the Bab el-Mandeb. That's the other choke point for Middle East oil, which the Bab el-Mandeb Strait guards the approaches to the Suez Canal through the Red Sea. So if you want to go from the Indian Ocean up to the Suez Canal, you have to go through the Bab el-Mandeb. That means all of the oil that goes by tanker from the Persian Gulf to Europe goes through the Bab el-Mandeb. Djibouti is on the Bab el-Mandeb. The Bab el-Mandeb at its narrowest point is 18 miles long. So Yemen is 18 miles away from China's Africa base. Their Africa base is a Middle Eastern base. So in very short order, we're going to have a military base in Pakistan that looks out at the Strait of Hormuz, and we already have a military base in Djibouti that looks out at the Bab el-Mandeb. The Chinese Navy is going through a massive expansion. It already has more ships than the American Navy. Within the next decade, it is going to have considerably more ships than the American Navy. By building that naval base in Djibouti, they have told us that they aspire to be the dominant power in the Indian Ocean. That also means the dominant power in the Persian Gulf. Now, why does all this matter? Because there's been a dogma for the longest time in Washington that China has no security interests in the Middle East. It takes on the major political and military issues in the Middle East, China takes a position of formal neutrality. And so what we have been telling ourselves, we Americans have been telling ourselves, is that China is happy with the American order in the Middle East. That they're basically a free rider. They know that we provide security and stability in the region, and that there are costs to us, reputational costs from playing that role, and they'd much rather that we play it rather than them. All they care about is extracting resources out of the region. They fear instability in the Middle East, and so there's a kind of perfect harmony of American interests and Chinese interests. That's only half the story, because as I began, the Chinese are viewing the Middle East with an eye to the East Asian balance of power. They are in. It's just illogical to think that we are their major adversary in the Pacific, but they're happy with our dominance in the Persian Gulf, through which all of their oil traverses. It doesn't make sense. So the conclusion that we came to is that the Chinese are actually, they have a contradiction at the heart of their policy. On the one hand, they want to supplant us as the dominant power in the Middle East, and they have a plan to get there. Maybe not a plan in the sense, they have a very strong intentions behind which they are putting resources to supplant us as the dominant power in the Middle East. On the other hand, they are benefiting from our position there, and they are vulnerable to us in a variety of ways. Were they to try now, in the current state of play, to supplant us, if they were to try to go directly at us, to topple us from our position as the preeminent power in the Middle East, it would be harmful to them. So they're biding their time and building up their strength. But they are also pursuing quietly and kind of surreptitiously an anti-American agenda in the region. And they do that by using Russia and Iran as their stalking horses. They let the Russians and the Iranians play the role of challenging the American order on the ground in a variety of different ways. And they support that from a distance. They're like the silent partners of the Russians and the Iranians. We've seen recently this news came out in the New York Times about the Chinese-Iranian deal, which the New York Times presented as unprecedented and presented as a huge blow to the Trump maximum pressure campaign. So the argument in the New York Times was that Trump left the JCPOA, put pressure on the Iranians, and the result was he created this incredible alliance between Iran and China. That's a lot of, as they say in political science, it's a lot of hooey. This Iran-Russia relationship is not new. It wasn't created by Donald Trump. It wasn't created by maximum pressure. The relationship, in exactly the same terms in which it was presented in the New York Times, was brokered in 2016, immediately upon the activation of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. So the minute there was the Iran nuclear deal, and it was actually after implementation day of the Iran nuclear deal, Xi Jinping went to Tehran, this deal was negotiated. It was announced then. The big numbers that they announced in 2016, they have never realized. Partially, I think, because the Chinese are a bit apprehensive about entering into such a military deal and with the Iranians and provoking the Americans. Is it troubling that China and Iran have this relationship? Yes, absolutely. It's absolutely troubling. It's not a result of maximum pressure, though. Maximum pressure is the answer to this, because there is this contradiction in Chinese policy. And the Obama administration's outreach to Iran, outreach to Russia, pulling back from the Middle East, it allowed Iran and China to have it both ways. It allowed Iran to be opposing us and our allies all across the region, but also to have sanctions relief and close economic relations with Western countries. So they could also to have the relationship with China. There was nothing about the JCPOA that prevented that. In fact, it encouraged it. So I think we need to put this in the right frame, and that's one of the goals of the article is to lay out the geostrategic map so that we can understand why it makes sense to weaken or defeat the Russian-Iranian alliance and Iran's Iran calls its resistance alliance. That is the sword by which the Chinese are undermining the Americans in the region. And I think it really is the Chinese. If you look at the totality of relations, say between the Russians and the Chinese, I think you can see that Xi Jinping, not Putin, is the senior partner in that relationship. Putin is vulnerable to the Chinese on many, many levels. And now the cooperation between Moscow and Beijing in all areas, economic, defense, research and development, and so on, it's unprecedented, or at least, we haven't seen it since the since before the Sino-Soviet split in the days of the Cold War. That's the essence of the argument. The essence of the argument is China, Russia, and Iran are working to undermine us. We haven't understood what the Chinese are up to because we haven't put it all together. We haven't put it all together carefully. It's very alarming, but it's and there's a certain amount of urgency to it. But it's not. But it's not something that we can't handle if we play our cards. If we play our cards correctly, one of the other problems with the Obama policy, which will probably become the Biden policy if Biden should win in November, is that China uses Iran and Russia in order to push the American allies toward Beijing. If you're Saudi Arabia and you're faced with an America that is supporting, and you're faced with a China that is supporting Iran, and an America that's pulling back, also supporting Iran, or at least allowing the rise of a nuclear Iran, and an America that is simultaneously hectoring you about your domestic political system and your involvement in Yemen, where you're trying to fight the Iranian proxy, right? Then your only choice is to try to, you know, patch things up with the Americans as well as you can, but then also to start looking to Beijing in order to get the Chinese to moderate the Iranians. So there's been a lot of hedging by the Saudis, and we saw it just in this Wall Street Journal piece this week about the Saudi the Saudi nuclear program that's being facilitated by the Chinese. There are other areas in which they're active together, and you also see it with Israel to a certain extent. I mean, the Israelis have signed a deal with China. They have a lot of major economic deals, but there's also a deal for the Israelis to build the port of Haifa, by the Israelis to have the Chinese build the port of Haifa. The Americans have asked the Israelis several times to end that deal, and the Israelis have said no. That's already a sign of erosion. What our allies want from erosion of the American position, what the allies want from us more than anything is our hard power security guarantee against their enemies. That takes us right back to the job of the United States is to crush the Iran's resistance alliance. And I don't think we have to do that through a major military operation. We don't need any more George W. Bush style invasions of Iraq. We have all the tools we can see between maximum pressure, covert action, working with our allies like the Israelis or, you know, in Syria. We have everything that we need to make life unlivable for the Iranians. We just need to stick to it. And I'll stop there. Thank you, Shoshana.
Thank you, Michael. That's a great roundup. We have some questions. Let me remind people that this is from an article that Michael Duran wrote in Tablet Magazine. So if you want to read the longer form of it, please go to Tablet Magazine and do that. So let's start with a very basic, very general question. Has the Wuhan virus made it easier for China, actually? Because the United States is staring at its navel most of the time. Have we dropped the ball on looking at foreign policy issues like the Uyghurs, like China moving to its own west?
I think it's a mixed bag. I don't think that the coronavirus global crisis cuts easily one way or the other. It's been very beneficial to the United States in that it has woken up the American public to the threat that is communist China. I think a lot of us were not aware until the whole thing with the until we saw the behavior of the Chinese with the virus, and we saw the way that they have, the way that the Chinese have co-opted the World Health Organization. Everyone suddenly was focused on it and saw it, and now we realize how much of this kind of co-optation the Chinese have been engaged in, and not just with international organizations, with our own research universities here in the United States and other businesses in the United States, with our allies, the Australia and Canada. There are two very good books one book I would recommend to everyone, it really woke me up. And I really didn't focus on it until the coronavirus myself. It's by Clive Hamilton. It's called Silent Invasion. And it's about the Chinese plan to take over Australia and to turn Australia into a kind of a tributary nation to China and to neutralize it. To borrow a term from the Cold War, I'd say to Finlandize Australia and take it out of the American orbit. It's very striking. It's a real wake up call. This book, it was a wake up call to Australians. It was big news in Australia, and it was all the bigger because this author, Clive Hamilton, was left wing. He's not known as a strong, supporter of the United States and the U.S. order, but he just started noticing that the Chinese were coming in and engaging in what some of the Australians are calling elite capture. Getting a hold, getting their hooks into the universities, buying off politicians, buying off companies, and so on, dropping a lot of cash on a lot of people, and then starting to dictate very aggressively to the Australian government what it needed to do. The Chinese Communist Party seems to have only two modes. One is courtship. And the other is dictatorship. It becomes a tyrant very quickly. So if you're on day one, you're an academic trying to do research, and they come in and they have great grants for you to do research, and then on day two they're demanding that you start giving over your research to them. By the time you're compromised, it's too late. We can see this happening in our own society and with big tech, with the NBA, all kinds of ways. And this is much deeper in Australia and Canada and Britain too. So our closest allies, Anglo-Saxon allies that we think would just automatically be with us, the Chinese have penetrated them significantly and have tried to pressure them. So that wake up that the coronavirus has been a very healthy thing, but we're recognizing that we have a very, very long road to go before we can position ourselves so that we're in the stronger position. We have a fight on our hands, I guess I would say, and we have some very strong assets to this fight. But it's not going to be simple. It's the biggest challenge since the Cold War, and it's as big as the Cold War, I would say.
And different from the Cold War in the sense that Russia was not much of a player on the world stage, and China is intimately involved in a lot of things with a lot of our allies. On the positive side of what you just said, the Australians are beefing up their military spending, and the British have thrown China out of the 5G program. But this raises another question someone has written into us. At the deepest level, the person writes, the interests of authoritarian governments often align better with other authoritarian regimes. Two questions. First of all, why do we think that countries like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan should be natural long-term allies of the United States? Does it make more sense that they would be long-term allies of China? And number two, we often mistake countries taking American money or arms or military training, like the Lebanese Armed Forces, with them adopting our values and our principles and our enemies. Should we care about values and principles? Or should we worry most about strategic location? That's a big question wrapped in another big question.
I'll take it. I'm just trying to figure out what order. I'll take it in the order in which it came. So with Saudi Arabia, the Chinese do have an advantage over us, I think, in that their propaganda hammers home this point all the time, which is that with us, it's win-win. It's government to government. We don't care about your domestic domestic order, and they understand that our democracy promotion and our criticism of say the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia and so forth has put impediments in the way of U.S.-Saudi relations, and they, the Chinese, can swoop in and capitalize on that. So it's absolutely true. But the Chinese are supporting the Iranians. And at some point, if they're interested in ousting us in the hard power game, they had to choose those. The Saudi, you know, the Saudi Iranian, as long as it's the Islamic Republic in Iran, the Saudi Iranian rivalry and conflict is baked into the equation. And at the moment, American policy has made it easy for the Chinese to play that, you know, we're your friend, win-win, because we have been so ambivalent about the Iran question. And I don't think that the Trump administration has been as ambivalent as the Obama administration, but America writ large has been very ambivalent. And we change our minds every 20 minutes. And the Trump administration has been somewhat ambivalent. And take the example of the Abqaiq attack that the Iranians did against the Saudis. I think the American response to Abqaiq was inadequate. I understand that a significant portion of Trump's base does not understand why we are in the Middle East. In fact, one of the reasons that I wrote the article was in order to make the case to the more isolationist, if I can use that word, wing of the Republican Party, that our power, our national power, our freedom actually depends on the Middle East, our position in the Middle East. Maybe not depend entirely, but our freedom will be endangered if the Chinese take over the Middle East. I won't go into the argument there, but I there's a long section in which I discuss just exactly how the balance of power against us will shift if the Chinese take it over. So Trump has kind of drew the line at killing Americans. So we didn't really respond to the Chinese, to the Iranians, when they were attacking the Saudis, but when they were trying to oust us from Iraq, by the way, notice what I said before. What's the area where the Chinese have made the greatest investment relative investment in recent years? Iraq. Where did the Iranians decide to try to oust us, to begin the ouster of us from the Persian Gulf? Iraq. I don't think that's an accident. That's an aside. But it wasn't until they killed Americans in Iraq that we killed Qasem Soleimani. Now that changed the relations with the Saudis. The Saudis said, they relaxed a little bit. And they said, maybe the Americans are here to stay, and maybe the Americans are actually serious about going head-to-head with the Iranians. But until they know that for sure, until they can see that we are really dedicated to seeing this through to the end, and they're not going to, you know, when after November and Joe Biden comes in November and says, back to the JCPOA, back to the sanctions relief for Iran. Let's spend another month and a half in Geneva negotiating with that used car salesman Zarif. You know, if the Saudis can very easily see how that may be American policy in just a few months, as long as that's the signals coming from the United States, they're going to hedge toward China. So that was question one. What was the question two?
I think you got them both, actually. He rolled over them both. Should we be worrying about what people do internally? You know, the Saudis are not exactly a free and democratic society. Neither is Pakistan. But if we need them for strategic purposes, what's the balance that you want to strike between being really nice to them, arming them, working with them, and knowing that we're arming and working with a country that's not nice to its own people or anyone else?
I've moved myself personally very much more into the realist camp. Traditionally, people who called themselves realists when talking about the Middle East were anti-Israel. Realism, both in its, realism in academia is Walt and Mearsheimer. Realism in the policy, Washington policy world was James F. the Jews, Baker, you know, they don't vote for us anyway. Those sorts of attitudes. Another point I tried to make in the article is the attraction to China of Israel. Israel is enormously attractive to China because China has a plan. It announced the plan. They called it China 2025, by which it's going to become the global leader in the next generation technologies that are going to fuel global economic growth and that are going to fuel the next generation of weaponry, military. They have a civil military fusion idea that is very dangerous to the United States. When they look at Israel, they don't just see the Jewish state, they see a cyber superpower. They see a leader in research and development on artificial intelligence. They see a country that is an innovator in next generation weaponry. And they see a country that has a unique access to the American techno-military complex. All of these things are enormously attractive to China, and they would love to take that away from the United States. So that's what I see too when I look at Israel, and I think that we want to have that country on our side in this contest. I think we want to have Saudi Arabia on our side because of the role that it plays in the global energy system, and I think that we have a chance to bring if there were regime change in Iran. And I'm not saying to argue for a regime change policy tomorrow, but I think in the long run, the Iranians understand that the Chinese are coming into Iran with a very heavy hand, and they are basically buying up Iranian assets at bargain basement prices, and the Iranians don't like outside domination. Let's go back to the first question that was asked. Nobody likes to be dominated. And the Americans are, even at their worst, are rather soft touch imperialists. The Chinese are not. The Chinese, when they come in, once they feel they own you, they start, like I said, they did to the Australians, they start dictating to you how it's going to be. Nobody likes to have somebody else's finger in their chest and told how they're going to do things. Personally, I think we have to wake up. We make a mistake when we go into a place like the Middle East and say, we're here to change you and transform you into democracies. Because look, number one, that's not why we're there. That's not our number one interest. It's just not. It's not our number two interest. It's not our number three interest. And so when we start saying that that's the central thing, one, we're being hypocritical. We're not being honest with ourselves. And then we get ourselves into all kinds of projects like democracy in Iraq that become the central project in our strategy that leads to a situation where Iraq is the great example. How much blood and treasure did we devote to Iraqi democracy only to create a vacuum into which China has moved? Wouldn't it have been better if we had just been a little bit more realist about it and looked at each one of these countries as assets that we want on our side? And being aware of the fact that we are Americans, we do have values. Values that permeate our system. And we're going to have conversations with the Saudis about their domestic arrangements, about their lack of democracy and so forth. But they're going to listen to us a lot more if they feel that they have an absolute ironclad security guarantee from us. If we come in and we hector them about human rights and democracy, and we don't provide a security guarantee at the same time, it's not like they're going to say, "Oh, we're going to transform our system and start a destabilizing democracy program because maybe that's the way to win over the Americans." It's unrealistic.
Okay, we have a few minutes left. You mentioned, and you go into more detail in it in the article, the Chinese base in Djibouti, which is next to the U.S. base in Djibouti, and it's 18 miles from Yemen. Djibouti has our only permanent base in Africa. So now we have our one permanent base in Africa and the Chinese have a base in Africa right next door. How's that working out?
Yeah, not so well. I mean, it's over, first of all, 8 miles, the Chinese decided to put their first overseas base 8 miles away from the only American base in Africa. That little factoid, I think, tells you everything you need to know. And they're using that base to surveil us, to try to penetrate the base. They've tried on numerous occasions to infiltrate the base. They are harassing planes that are taking off from the base. They've used lasers, military-grade lasers, to flash in the eyes of American pilots, and so on. So it tells you, doesn't tell you anything about the strategy behind the base, but it tells you something about the spirit of the forces on the ground with respect to the American forces.
Thank you. And I think this is probably going to be our last question. And maybe it's a good news question. I always like to end with a positive response from our speaker. So keep this in mind, Mike, as I ask you. You mentioned that China is the sort of senior partner over Russia in a lot of ways now, and the things that they do together in the region, or the things that they are bumping up against each other in the region. And China is making this enormous investment in Iraq, and China's building this, and China's building that. A lot of this seems to depend on China's economy continuing to go forging ahead in the future. What happens if it doesn't? Now, we've spent the last 5 or 6 years talking about the impending collapse of the Chinese economy, and it doesn't collapse. But what if it is not sustainable in the future? Does the threat go away?
Well, if trend lines remain the same as they have been for the last decade, then it looks like almost inevitable that the Chinese are going to overtake us in the Middle East at some point, you know, by 2030, 2040. But of course, that kind of projection is impossible. So that leads me to the conclusion that we have to go on the offense if we don't want to give up the Middle East to them. And I think that would be a strategic disaster. We do have to go on the offense somewhere. I don't think it should be military offense. So that takes me to economics. And as you note, a lot of economic experts, I'm certainly not one, but a lot of economic experts have pointed out that this is that there are a lot of flaws in the a lot of weaknesses in the Chinese economy. They are dependent on their economic relations with us. We have options that they don't have. And I don't want to start suggesting specific things that we should be doing, because I'm not an economic expert. But for the starting point, we should look closely at this civil-military fusion that they have. Their notion of how they're going to take their military to the next level and their economy to the next level is through these next-generation technologies. Like Huawei is a good example. It should be an absolute priority of the United States to deny them those capabilities and to get them out of our research institutions. Stop building up. We have been helping them develop the tools of our own destruction for a very long time. And if we can at least just stop that, that would be a great thing. I don't think they can innovate the way we can in their system. But then if we could also go on the attack a little bit and take things away from them, that would be great. That would be even better.
That's almost a positive response, which we appreciate. And I'm going to draw this conversation to a close. Michael Duran, thank you for an enlightening session, much better understanding of China, China's role in the Middle East, and things that we need to be doing to shore up our own position. Ladies and gentlemen, as I said, this is our last video webinar for the month of August. We will see you again after Labor Day. Thank you very much.
Thank you.